Test. This is Dave Crippen, and this is October 23rd, 1987, and this is the another one of our design history oral interviews. And today we are speaking with Bob. Do you have a middle initial? Robert E. Burke, B-O-U-R-K-E. Is it pronounced Burke or Bork?
It's Burke.
Burke, good. Of Loewy Studebaker fame and many other design, notable automotive design areas. And we'd like to ask Mr. Burke to tell us his career story in his own way and at his own pace. Basically, Bob, we'd just like you to sort of begin at the beginning. Talk about where you grew up, where you were born, where you grew up, what your influences were. Maybe a
nice book.
Yeah. Maybe a
thank you.
Favorite relative or a friend or a mentor in school who got you started on.
All right. Fine.
Okay.
Fine. And of course it'll be edited as I stammer and try to.
No problem.
All right. Any case, I was born in Chicago on June the 15th, 1916. I'm 71 and still going strong. Most days, except today. Any case, on the southwest side of Chicago, in an area called Beverly Hills, was born in the house and lived there until I moved out of Chicago to South Bend, Indiana to go to work for Studebaker. Well, I went to Morgan Park High School in the neighborhood. It was about a mile and a half from my house at 111th Street and a couple of blocks west of Vincennes Avenue. Uh-huh. And from there, during the time as a young kid, I was very much interested in airplanes. Built a lot of model airplanes. And then at the time when I was about 11 or 12 years old, I used to endeavor to design automobiles. I was gifted with the ability to draw and sketch, and if I could had an idea, I could put it in three-dimensional form with lead pencil on any kind of paper available. My interest in aircraft as a young fellow, I would get on my bicycle and I'd ride it about 6.5 miles, starting out when it was almost still dark in the morning, and go out 95th Street to Cicero Avenue and turn right on Cicero Avenue and go about 1.5 miles north on Cicero, and there was an airport there called Ashburn Field, and it happened to be the original site of the factory, the wartime factory. I don't know whether it was owned by Ford, one of the, or GM, but they manufactured, and I'm not sure about this either, during the war, they manufactured armaments or something there. It was a large factory. Eventually, Preston Tucker took over at the same place that Preston Tucker moved his automobile, endeavored to start up his automobile company. Well, in any case, at the time,
that was the Dodge engine plant.
That's what it was. That's absolutely right. The Dodge aircraft engine plant.
In Cicero.
And what I would do is I'd go to the airport there, and there was a chap by the name of E.M. Laird, Matty Laird, L-A-I-R-D. Uh-huh. And Matty had his factory at the east end of the airport. There was one landing strip, it was a cinder landing strip, and in that factory he built the Laird Solution and Laird Super Solution, which held the land speed records for the world, as a matter of fact. And old Matty had lost one leg in an airplane accident, and I was just a very young kid, and he'd see me out there on weekends. And he finally got to know me and sort of figured I was maybe a lost son or something like that, so he took the time to tell me about his airplanes and his showed me his factory and showed me how they constructed these things. And then I got to know his chief test pilot by the name of Speed Holman. Uh-huh. and Speed.
H-O-L-M-A-N.
That's right. Mm-hmm. He's a big, tall Swedish fellow. Lanky, I'd guess. He seemed to be about 6 foot six to me as a young kid, but I would imagine he'd maybe be more like 6 foot three. Mm-hmm. Extremely thin. Mm-hmm. Had very little to say. And I'll never forget the days that Speed had take the solution up. It was primarily the solution that I saw. That's the first one that held the record. And like, for instance, early in the morning I'd arrive, Speed would be standing around with his helmet on and one thing and another, and Matty would be talking to him, and there'd be a mechanic or two tinkering with the engine or something like that. And they had to take part of the fuselage off so that Speed could get in. It was a very narrow fuselage of these clipped, it was a biplane with clipped wings. And so it'd be time for Speed to assemble himself in the cockpit, and Matty would tell him, "Now, Speed, no fancy stuff. Just take the aircraft down," he said, "take off at a nice level run, no fancy stuff. When you get to the end, then do your climb, do a rollover, and come back on down, and we're timing it through the traps. And I want you to make maybe 3, 4, or 5 runs if everything is going good, as far as the engine performance is concerned. And don't forget, nothing fancy." "Okay, Mr. Laird." He'd get in, that's about all he'd say. "Okay, don't worry, Mr. Laird. I'll bring the plane back in one piece." And he'd get in, and it'd take him about 10 or 15 minutes to fasten the side of the fuselage. And I don't know how in the world he'd ever get out. Of course, he wouldn't. He wouldn't be able to bail out. Mm-hmm. Funny part of it is, he had a chute on. He sat on a chute. But maybe he had a special way in which he could kick himself out. I don't know. But in any case,
his own method of ejection.
Yeah, probably tear the fuselage apart just like this. Anyhow, Speed to get in, and it had a large Wright Cyclone engine on it. I think it was a single row, not a twin row. I think then it went to one of the early twin row Pratt & Whitney Wasps. That was a super solution. And off he'd go. He'd take off, he'd way down at the end of the runway, and he'd warm the thing up, and then he'd throw the throttle on it, go down the runway, and the cinders would start to fly, and he'd hold the thing right on the runway till he got up to fairly good speed. I just don't know how fast, but then the runway was quite a long one, by the way. Mm-hmm. And he'd do a barrel roll. He would never take the thing off safely. He would do a barrel roll, and he'd get it up just high enough so that the wings looked like they were about 6 inches off of the, and he'd roll it, and he'd roll it right straight down. And Matty Laird would do this and shut his eyes, and he'd just hold his head and go back and forth like this, and then he'd look. Speed would make maybe 3 complete barrel rolls right down the runway, and then pull the thing up in a complete climb, go straight up in the air, do a rollover, come back, go down through the traps. And the rest of the thing was, he would fly it just the way he should, and he'd go through the traps, he'd make 3, 4, 5 runs, and come back on down. And then Matty would just, you know, shake his head, really give him hell. And it was pretty good. Well, in any case, this is a long, breezy bit of conversation.
No, that's fascinating.
But in any case,
that cemented your
my interest in speed,
right,
and my interest in aircraft.
Aircraft.
And from there, I went to that's for you, I think.
No.
Oh. I went to the Chicago Art Institute. Things were getting tough. As far as my father was concerned, he had lost quite a bit of money in the crash of 29, mm-hmm. early 30s. Matter of fact, he was dead broke. Mm-hmm. But I went to the Chicago Art Institute and paid for my tuition there by getting up. I'd get up extremely early, be completely blackout, and I'd get to the Institute at 7 o'clock in the morning, and I had to ride the Rock Island Railroad train into the Loop in Chicago. Mm-hmm. Then I'd walk from LaSalle on Durbin Street over to Adams in Michigan, and it'd be dead black, and it'd be about 14 below zero.
Oh, I remember
and these,
well.
Oh,
yes.
You know the area.
Yes, right.
I used to just freeze, but I'd walk generally down Van Buren Street, and there was a elevated track right above in the alleys in between, and mm-hmm. you'd see these bums,
yeah.
sitting up against the building eating sterno with a spoon.
Right, exactly.
Oh, you've been there.
Well, okay. I may have seen something like that.
Oh, my Lord. I used to see them every day, and I just, you know, I couldn't believe it. And there would be sub-zero weather. Well, I imagine there's
antifreeze,
quite a
few. Antifreeze,
yeah, antifreeze. I imagine there were quite a few of them frozen to death.
Oh, yeah.
But in any case, then I went to the Art Institute and I'd clean the floors until about 10 o'clock in the morning, wash out the latrines and all that kind of stuff, and that took care of a good amount of my tuition. Then as I, so I took fine arts and primarily oil painting, a certain amount of design. The only design that they had, for instance, is the study of flat patterns through the ages and all kinds of things of that nature, you know what I mean? And then writing reports on that and so forth. It was interesting, and it was a very good place to get a good foundation of what art was all about.
Good discipline.
Yeah, very good. And in that regard, in the summers, I would work for my dad in his architectural office. And in that regard, he could see that I was interested in mechanical things also, and in architecture. At one point, I thought I'd proceed as an architect, only he was having such a struggle at the time. He advised me to maybe to think about something else. But in any case, I took some architectural courses at Armour Institute, which was literally, they had a subsidiary of it across the street, and they also had a branch of Chicago University across the street. So I had some time at Armour Institute, which I enjoyed very much. It was mechanical engineering there. In the Chicago University, I took some regular straight college courses in relation to writing and things of that nature. Not too many of them, but in any case, I got
it. All in the depths of the Depression?
Yeah, just it was all in the depths of the Depression. There was very little money. I remember I used to bus dishes and food at the Entre Cafeteria on East Adams Street.
Really?
Between Michigan Avenue and Wabash Avenue. And I got my lunch that way.
Sure.
I'd work there about an hour and a half or so, and then give you a plate of beans and some hot dogs, and that'll be it.
Yeah, right.
Well, that's sort of the early beginning of the thing, and well,
you had quite a good grounding, didn't you?
Well, it was interesting, yeah.
For industrial design, yeah.
Yeah, it kept me going, and I was pretty much a lively guy, you might say, and interested in stuff.
Awesome.
And I was, you know, pretty strong. Mm-hmm. Although when I was a young kid, I was sick as hell for years with an appendix they didn't know that I had, and it was in the lodged in the left rear back, my back, and I was sick for maybe 4 or 5 years, and they finally operated on me and found out what it was, too late, you might say.
Burst.
And it had burst, and it had many adhesions to my bowel, and they had tubes in me as a kid. You know, they didn't have any antibiotics. And,
oh, wow.
But I pulled out of that one, so I'm still here.
That's great.
But after I passed about 12 years old, I was, you know, I got strong then.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So in any case, I needed a job after a couple of years of that, and I went to Sears Roebuck and Company, and they gave me a job. I had made up some samples and things that I thought I could do for them.
Yeah.
And I was hired at Sears and worked for a man by the name of Clarence Karstadt. K-A-R-S-T-A-D-T. And Clarence, at the time, I would imagine, was a man maybe about 41 or 2 or 3 or 4 at the most. I worked for Clarence for about a year and a half. Then at one point they had a layoff, cut back. And I was laid off for 3 months, and then they called me up and put me back to work again.
Did they have their own industrial design department there?
Mm-hmm. And it was home in the Northington Street, the tower building. We were up in the top of the tower, the top two or three floors.
What street are those again?
Homan, H-O-M-A-N, in Arlington.
Arlington?
It was on the west side.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the industrial design department was headed up by a man by the name of A.J. Snow, Doc Snow, Dr. Snow.
Mm-hmm.
He was a hard-bitten, short little guy, spoke with an accent, and he was a doctor of philosophy, I think. And where he got his doctorship, I believe, was somewhere in the East, in one of the Eastern colleges. But he convinced the management of Sears Roebuck they should have a merchandise development division, which they called it in those days. And in that regard, they worked on everything from refrigerators to farm equipment, home shop tools and things of that nature, well, just about anything.
Mm-hmm.
Radios, luggage, furniture. Well,
they did their in-house design in those
days. Yeah, most all of it.
Yeah.
And it was interesting because Clarence Garstedt was my boss, and there were Larry Hosey, Wally Nesson, myself, a lady by the name of, a young girl by the name of Eleanor Litzy, and that was comprised the bullpen, you might say.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I started out cutting mats and doing menial things, and then finally they found out I could draw pretty well, and so they put me to work. And one of the first things I did, I think it's in the book there, is a Graham Bradley 75 manure spreader.
Really?
Yes, and this consisted of a buckboard, and on the back of it was a wheel that went around a circle like this, and you'd put the manure in the front, and you'd pitchfork the manure into the wheel as the horses pull the wagon along. And the other nickname for it was unfortunately I shouldn't say it, but they used to call them the farm's shit slingers.
Sure.
And it would literally sling the stuff out. Well, all I did with the darn thing was, I think I did some painting. In other words, the paint scheme was basically red. Red and black is what they painted their farm equipment at that time. That is the wagons in particular. And I put a big 75 on the side of it. And that was a great thing. Well, then,
who did their farm equipment in those days?
Who did their what? Oliver Farm and Equipment Company did some of them. And I think that Oliver made those. And at that time, Oliver was in South Bend, strangely.
Really?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It might have been Oliver, it might have been, I don't know whether it was John Deere was in business, I really don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But I know Oliver was in business, and I know Oliver did do some things for them.
Mm-hmm.
So it might have been Oliver. On the other hand, they might have bought the buckboard from somebody else, an old wagon manufacturer like
right.
Studebaker.
Right. When they're over
right.
their stock. Yeah.
I'm going to try some of this delicious coffee.
Please. Well, you enjoyed yourself in Sears. That was your first real...
Well, yes, and it was a period of learning and a period of rubbing shoulders with fellas. It developed from my first working with Clarence Karstadt, and he had a very great ability to draw and sketch. He was fast as hell. He was a burning German fellow that just didn't have time for any foolishness at all. And the speed with which he would draw... He'd see me fumbling and wanting to put some construction lines to get perspective right, and he'd said, well, Bob, can you draw without those lines? Can you see the vanishing points in your head? I said, yeah, I can see them. He said, well, let's see you draw without any vanishing points at all.
Mm-hmm.
Don't use any straight edges. Don't do anything. Let me see you draw freehand.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and that was one of the good things that he helped me with. Then, after a while, Jack Morgan... from General Motors. Jack Morgan, he had a nickname at General Motors. Matter of fact, Gordon Burek mentioned this to me because Gordon was at GM when Jack was there.
Mm-hmm.
And his nickname was Juan Ricardo. And he had a very thin little mustache. And Juan Ricardo was a real dandy. He dressed to the teeth. It was
mm-hmm.
neat, and he drew designs, tiny little sketches. In other words, he would do a space heater. It would be about an inch and a half high. Now, this is not exaggerating.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a long lead pencil, and he kept it extremely sharp. And the detail on this thing was unbelievable. And he would take one piece of paper and put 12 different designs on it, each one of them measuring about an inch and a half. And I'd watch that man. I couldn't believe it, the way this fella drew. And he was a real expert. Matter of fact, he is the man. You probably remember the old LaSalle that had the portholes on the side of it and the long narrow hood.
Right.
He had the most to do with that particular car.
Really?
Yeah. In any case, at one point, he sort of took a shine to me. He could see I could draw fairly well. He said, how would you like to help me out? I said, I sure would, Mr. Morgan. He said, well, come on up. We'll put a board right over here. You can work right behind me there, and you can sort of see how I'm doing things, and you can help me out on some of this stuff. And I said, boy, that would be just great. So I moved up to Jack Morgan's office. So there was Jack Morgan and myself. And he used to talk automobiles. He could talk automobiles and draw equipment for Sears Roebuck all at the same time. And I watched him, and I learned a tremendous amount from Jack Morgan. Then while we were there, a man showed up. I believe he was, well, I know he was from Germany. And he had just managed to get out of Germany in time before Hitler shut the door on him. His name was Doc Schneider. He also was, he actually was a Bauhaus type of designer. And he was well into his 50s. A tall, dark man, a gentle guy, a hell of a nice man. And I watched Doc Schneider. He did furniture and things of that nature, way and beyond the ability for Sears to understand or appreciate what this man was doing. But mm-hmm. boy, could he draw. Another one, a real expert. Mm-hmm. So those three men were really outstanding. Then a young fellow came along by the name of Claire Hodgman. And at this time, we moved the development center from the tower building over to the building across the street and took the whole top floor. And we had a shop, and the whole merchandise development division increased in size. There were contact men there and everything else. In other words, we would design objects that in turn would be built by a company, and the contact men would take the information from Sears and our drawings and work with the corporation in wherever it was, in the south or the north. So we had a great number of fellows there, contact men and designers. And at this point, Claire Hodgman showed up on the scene. And Claire Hodgman came from Raymond Loewy Associates.
H-O-D-G-M-A-N.
Claire, by the way, had worked at General Motors for a while. And then he had done some early Studebakers before he came to Sears Roebuck. Mm-hmm. The early Champions and the 40 line of Studebakers that were pretty darn nice. Claire had a big hand in that. Yeah,
40?
Mm-hmm. In that area, mm-hmm. or in that period, time period. The 40, which had a sharp nose, and the catwalk grills. It was a tough car, too. That was a very sturdy car with an X frame. So Claire showed up on the scene. He was a single fellow and a few years older than I was, and boy, he could draw like gangbusters. Mm-hmm. You know, I just had the opportunity to see some of the best people in the business. And Claire and I became quite good friends. We were both single guys, and I looked up to him, and boy, could he drink booze. I was never able to do it. Matter of fact, I'm suffering today from a get together with Tucker last night. And a couple other guys. In any case, I'm not used to that kind of stuff. I never could really handle much booze, fortunately.
Good.
So if I sound a little quaky, it's only because I've got a hangover. But anyhow, Claire and I became pretty close friends. Mm-hmm. And while Claire was at Sears, and it's just about a year and a half or so, during that period, he got married to his girlfriend back east, Alice. And they're still married to this day, and Claire lives in Daytona. Anyhow, Claire knew Exner, and he had met Exner at GM at one period when Verge was at GM.
Yeah.
So they were close friends, mm-hmm. fairly close, in any case.
Verge Exner was even then, though, fairly well known.
Oh, yeah. Well, he was at Studebaker then,
right,
see?
Yeah.
And working for Loewy. Mm-hmm. And Claire worked for Loewy before
came to Sears.
Before he came to Sears, and the reason that Sears grabbed Claire was the fact that Loewy had done the cold spot refrigerator, which was a famous industrial design job. The first time they took put the compressor and stuff, hid it out of sight, and put Sears Roebuck on the map as, I guess, in total sales of refrigerators, they were ahead of everybody at that. Yeah. So Claire was hired by Sears because they needed an in-house designer, and they felt that they could probably get the designs for quite a bit less money by hiring the man that did the job. Sure. And it was Claire that did the job on the refrigerators.
Finished up the Lowy design, was that it?
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. So Claire primarily did refrigerators while I was there at Sears Roebuck. But
it was a famous design.
Oh, yeah. The cold spot and the dished-in area right behind the spot, which in turn had a vertical handle, and this, you know, those things.
Millions of housewives blessed your memory for that. Whatever memory of that.
I had really nothing to do with it, but it was before my time, but yeah. Claire did that one, and uh-huh. Concurrently, or later on, he did quite a bit of work for Frigidaire, which the fellows at GM didn't know about, mm-hmm. as a matter of fact. Flew back and forth from Dayton, Ohio, one thing and another, but that was a later date. A prior date, as a matter of fact. Yeah, it was prior. Well, any case, X and Claire would talk once in a while on the phone or get together on occasion because they were old friends. And X mentioned that he sure would like to have a designer to help him.
Mm-hmm.
And Claire said, well, there's a fellow I know here at Sears that draws cars whenever he can get the chance, you know. Mm-hmm. And maybe you'd like to see his stuff and see what you think. And so X said, sure, send him down. And so I heard about that and got all my sketches together and made a few new ones and went down to see Virg Exner. And
what was your impression when you first met him?
Oh, I thought he was a grand guy. Uh-huh. And I was excited as
uh-huh.
hell.
Uh-huh.
So the first thing I had to do was a fellow by the name of Perry Sullivan, who was head of the body engineering division.
Mm-hmm.
We had a building on Sample Street, and it was divided. A chassis division was on one side, and there was a court in the middle, and the body division was on the other side, although there were walkways in between. It wasn't a huge, big building. But in any case, Perry Sullivan interviewed me to begin with, mm-hmm. and I showed him my things, and then he called X in, and X came forward, and I met X for the first time, and I guess Perry said, well, excuse me, and he left me with Virg, and Virgil looked at my stuff, and he said, well, how would you like to work here? And I said, I'd be very much interested. And he said, do you think $75 a week would do it for you? At the time, I had been raised from $25 a week to $40 a week, and I said, well, it's more money than I've ever heard of before. And I said, fine, when do you want me to start? Now? I said, well, I'll have to at least give them a couple of weeks' notice. And
mm-hmm.
So we set a date, and that's how I ended up a Studebaker.
Yeah. Nice, easy entree.
It was very simple in those days. Well, when I arrived, X introduced me to the fellows in the body division. And
what
also,
year was this?
It was 40 or 41. I'm not sure. It was either the latter part of 40 and the early part of 41, right around in there, I believe.
What were the prospects in those days for further production? Were you still hoping that you could still produce automobiles?
Well, and hopefully,
yeah,
you know.
Right.
And they were looking forward to it. And I first started doing some work for X. And my whole, all I was asked to do is just sit down and draw and give him idea sketches,
right. Right.
One after the other. And the way I worked at that time was primarily on 9x11 sheets of white paper, tablet paper, literally.
Uh-huh, right.
Just bond paper.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd made many, many sketches, just one right after the other. I'd crank the darn things out. I never had so much fun in my life, you know. It was really terrific.
Yeah.
And some of them were worse than others. And there were some nice ones, too. That is, sketches and ideas and one thing and another. Working with X and myself was a young fellow by the name of Frank Alroth, A-L-H-R-O-T-H, and I do not know where Frank is now. I saw him once about 12 years ago. He dropped into our office in New York City just to say hello.
Really?
And it was grand to see him. He had lost his wife. He had two or three children, I guess, and they were growing up at the time. And he was a very talented, terrific guy as far as modeling was concerned. He didn't consider himself a designer. He couldn't draw, mm-hmm. but he could sure as hell model. And he could look at a drawing and put it up in three dimensions, you know. Well, X would model and I would model, you know, on occasion. We'd really get into the play and you know how it is. Mm-hmm. And Frank, so there was the three of us.
Clay in
your shoes and hands and fingernails and every piece of silver change in your pocket turned black and all that sort of thing with the sulfur. And we worked in an area on Sample Street. It was a fairly large room with large aluminum drafts dividing the room in half. There were about anywhere from 3 to 4 body draftsmen in there. They didn't necessarily work with us. They in turn were they in turn were given assignments to do component parts for trucks, primarily trucks. I think they were basically doing a lot of 4x4 work for the Army because they were getting into truck production. And then there were specialized vehicles, which in turn were being designed at all times. Some of them were built, some of them weren't, some of them went into production. But there was always a tremendous amount of work for these fellows to do. Things got hot and heavy with the war going on, and they needed more hands doing drafting work. Well, I had originally learned that sort of thing working for my father, and I worked in two areas of architecture, and he was primarily an architect for the large buildings in Chicago. Some of them still stand, by the way.
Really?
Yeah. And matter of fact, his office was originally called Jenny and Mundy, J-E-N-N-E-Y and M-U-N-D-I-E. And old man Jenny, and my dad worked there at the time as a young fellow. Mr. Jenny was a structural engineer. And he, in turn, in the actual history books, you can find out that the first skyscraper steel construction building was built in Chicago at 39 South LaSalle Street. It's since been torn down. And they put this building up, I think it was 12 to 14 floors high, by building the steel structure, as we've seen large buildings go up, and to publicize the fact that this was a new way of doing things, they started to lay bricks at the fifth floor, and they filled the walls in and completed the building from the fifth floor to the top, and nothing but steel structure below it holding it. Mm-hmm. That was the first time that they dug caissons, which in turn are large round diameter deep pits. You know, Chicago is a built on a sort of a swamp, you might say, and they had to go down to bedrock. Mm-hmm. And they sunk these caissons down and then set the big steel beams. I remember seeing some details and pictures of that they took of this building going up in the office, and they had them on the walls, a lot of them. And old man Jenny at the fifth floor, he had a beard, as a matter of fact, and I was so impressed with that. And of course, that was a very famous building. And to this day, they don't credit Jenny in some of the articles you read. Jenny and Mundy for the development of the first all-steel skyscraper construction. They give the credit to, who is it? It wasn't Louis Sullivan. Louis Sullivan was a very famous architect. I can't remember the name right now, but in any case, and then I think it's been clarified now as I've dropped a number of letters to people who have written magazine articles and one thing and another too. That's all right. Mm-hmm. Just so I don't wreck your equipment here. So with that background of working for a structural engineer by the name of Grimmison. He was a German fellow with a heavy German accent, as a matter of fact, and he was G-R-I-M. It's Grimmison, and I really forget how he spelled it. I know he had a son by the name of Jack, and I know Jack went to Jack was a, we can fill it in later. So Grimason showed me quite a bit about structural engineering and how to lay things out. And as a kid, he would give me a specific job to do, and I'd work in these big darn drawings and, you know, slide across on my stomach, literally. We didn't work standing up like they do in the automobile companies. We did it on flat drafting tables.
Right.
And being young and flexible, I could reach certain lines that this great big German guy had a hard time putting his beer stomach around in. And so they used me on that, and I did learn how to do some particular types of layout drawings, one thing or another. And then with a certain amount of mechanical engineering ability at Studebaker, they ran into trouble and they needed hands and they couldn't get them. And so they swung me into the chassis division of Studebaker, which in turn had been cordoned off, and that became part of the U.S. Air Corps contract to develop a new internal combustion engine for the Air Corps. And this was a very interesting thing to me, again, getting back to aircraft again, and it was just a delight to see how these fellows went about it. And the man by the name of Tilly was in charge of this, and he was a very well-known internal combustion aircraft designer. And there was quite a group of guys, and Frank Allroth was swung in from doing clay modeling automobiles to do clay modeling for internal combustion chambers and things like that. Well, to make the long story short, the idea there is to develop a large engine, air-cooled, which in turn would be situated literally in the center of a large bomber fuselage with the power trains going out to the wings and driving four propellers. And an 8-inch bore, eight to nine inch, is about as big as we got with a single cylinder, and we developed with a twin, with double twin turbochargers, something like close to 300 horsepower with one 8-inch bore single cylinder. Then we went from a single to doubles. Now it might have been the twin, the two cylinder job that developed the 300 horsepower, probably was, but they were big, huge, and they had to be run in on dynamometer tests in special rooms where, in turn, the components were so darn big that the coefficient of expansion in the aluminum, this is the crank and the piston and all, were such that it was very difficult to keep the engine together at high RPMs. Mm-hmm. But they finally got that whip, but they were in cages, you know, so that when they did break loose, it didn't blow the room out, you might say, so they had like half-inch steel bar meshes on 1-inch centers or so, that very little air coming in, and then they had a secondary mesh in case something got through those meshes, it'd be stopped with a second bunch of stuff, and they'd build these engines one after the other with modifications and changes, and you know, money was no object, but boy, they needed manpower. Then we'd set them up, and then we'd run them in. Then we'd have bets on how long this engine would last, you know, and run them till they broke.
Really?
Yeah, literally just blew them all up. Or they'd fracture, some of them would fracture in some place, and we'd take them down, save the components, make a change, or have a change ready for it, you might say. So this was a period that I enjoyed very much. And then as the war began to cool down, I went back with Virg Exner, and Frank Allroth stayed with Tilly a little bit longer, and then all of a sudden jet engines began to come through, and the Chippewa plant on the south end of the Studebaker group, the new war Chippewa plant, which in turn they built 4x4s in there and trucks, primarily army trucks, they cordoned off a division of that, and they began to test jet engines in there. And now jet engines were beginning to come through, and they had these jet engine cages, and they take the engine and they put the engine in a vertical position, and then they take the jet exhaust, you might say, and they blow it right up the top of large tall smokestacks, and they'd run anywhere from 6 to 8 of those at a time, breaking them in and making them well, when it was obvious that the jet engine was going to replace the internal combustion engine, that more or less slowed down the Tilly project, is what we call it. Well, from there we went back to designing automobiles, and X and I were there, and then Frank eventually swung back into the car work again. He started in a little bit later than I did. Well, as the story goes, there was a period of time there, and all the time, X never seemed to get along very well with Loey. Loey would show up out there from time to time, and X would mumble under his breath. X could get mad at somebody and stay mad forever, you know? Yeah. He didn't like the way Loey took the credit for everything, and he was that type of a guy. The one thing he didn't understand was the fact that about everything in this world has to be promoted or sold in some way or another, and it's not the guy that really does the thing. It's awfully important to have somebody that can give that guy the opportunity to design something. So it takes a whole group of things to happen to transpire that allows somebody to have the opportunity to design cars or what have you, aside from the engineering and everything else. Well, in any case, let me think a bit here. Where am I? I'm back with X. Frank is back in on the job, and we're beginning to put together some automobiles. And at that time,
about 44. 45.
Yeah, it was the preliminary work for the early post-war 47s.
Right.
Now, the facelifts that came out directly after automobile production started up after the war.
It was about mid-45.
Yeah, right. Now, actually, X didn't get involved with those. I did those. Those, just the grills.
Mm-hmm,
and
right.
We put a new front grill on the Champion and the Commander series, and it was primarily just horizontal stainless steel bars because they could buy them in great quantities, pre-made, and then they'd outline them and put a trim around the outside, and
mm-hmm.
How can we get a facelift on this thing for real fast, you know, and that was the idea, do it overnight. So X said, well, you go ahead and do that, Bob, and I said, well, okay, I know, what do you think of this is, and he said, well, it looks okay to me, go ahead, and so I just put my head down, away we'd go, and I get a hold of the engineers, and I got the darn thing and slammed it up on the cars and showed it to management just about that fast, and gosh, they looked at it and they thought it was just great, like anything would be great.
Sure.
You know, they really didn't give a damn, except it did look pretty good,
big
actually.
Sellers market.
Oh, my gosh. So, and so they hit the market. And that was literally my first example of something that I contributed that got out into production.
Kind of exciting to see it.
Oh gosh, yeah. You bet your life. And to this day, I've got some of the things I designed at Sears Roebuck, like a flashlight. It's been knocking around the house for years.
Really?
And, you know, a few things like that. Some power tools I still have. I still operate them, as a matter of fact. Anyhow, what are we talking about now? Well,
you're starting to work on the 47. This was a big push, wasn't it?
Well, yeah, right. Well, we had done work on a symbolic 47, you might say, that in turn had a grill on the back end of it. And I had a lot of sketches with a glass curved around in the back and all that, one thing and another. And so we built a wood model of this very early pre-47 prototype, which had some of the characteristics of the production car, albeit they were somewhat different. It didn't have a fender as such on the rear end, and had a detail around the back, and it had a grill across the back, and the car actually was being considered for a rear engine automobile.
Right.
Yeah.
Whose idea was that?
Well, it wasn't necessarily just ours. We thought it would be a good idea, and we talked to Chassis, and at the time, there's a Roy Cole was vice president in charge of engineering, and he thought, well, you know, it could be a good idea, and so forth and so on. And he had familiar with Porsche's attempts and that sort of thing. And at one point, they did contact Porsche, and Porsche built a rear-engine car for them.
They did?
Yeah. It's a rather ugly-looking machine, but mechanically, it was a pretty good car, as a matter of fact. They built two cars. One of them was a straight rear-engine car, and the other one was a front-engine rear-wheel drive car.
Uh-huh.
One being a rear-engine rear-wheel drive car, the other one a front-engine rear-wheel drive car. It's hard for me to recall them now. I think that's what it was. Anyhow, so then Loey and X began to squabble pretty heavy, to the degree that it just wasn't going to work. You could see that. In any case, we moved from the Sample Street building over to the 48 building across from the administration building, and took a whole top floor of this building, which Lowy began to build a department up. And at that time, X and Frank were working on the 47 in X's basement, which in turn they had some dimensions, and they were working like hell and wanted to beat Lowy out of the thing, and
Frank
Allroth.
Mm-hmm. Did this have the concurrence of any top brass? This clandestine
Roy Cole.
Roy Cole.
Yeah,
he was the evil genius
now,
behind
this. Well, I don't know whether he told any of the other top brass about it or not.
Oh.
I just don't know.
Uh-huh.
Vance might have known about it. Who knows? I don't know. But in any case,
Paul Hoffman's still around those days.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, he'd come back
very much.
More.
Very much.
Yeah.
He was around.
Yeah.
He was a hell of a nice guy. I like Paul.
Yes.
G. Hoffman, Mr. Hoffman, pardon me. And Mr. Vance. Anyhow, and actually, there's a lot of the things that Frank and X and I worked that showed up on that car. You know, we worked a lot of the details out.
Mm-hmm.
All. Actually, the only thing that really wasn't done by myself or Frank or X was the front end detail of that car. That is the grill, which mm-hmm. is one of the outstanding things on the Champion especially.
Right.
The grill was done by Vince Gardner, believe it or not. Yeah.
Was he with the Lowy Group?
He was with the Lowy Group. And the grill, at one point, the car was chosen, the body was chosen, but management wasn't happy with the front end that was on it at the time.
Yeah.
That X and Frank had put on it. And so how I know how half this happened. Gordon Burig was hired by Lowy to run the organization in conjunction with Virg Exner. I mean, these were two title guys. And one week Gordon would be in charge, and the next X would be in charge, depending on the mood Lowy was in, who was running the place. See?
Uh-huh.
But the two guys, the minute Lowy left, they got along together. X and Gordon always got along real fine. And it just went along just like it ever did. It made no difference at all, you know, except
no,
Lowy.
In effect, Burig was the catalyst that pulled the group together once Lowy had left the South Bend.
Well, in a way, he hired the majority of the new people.
Yeah,
he did.
Who were they?
So, well, there was Johnny Reinhart,
uh-huh.
and Vince Gardner.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so let's get back to the front end. In any case, that's the reason. That's how Vince got on it, the
uh-huh.
job, because the management contacted Lowy that they wanted a little different front end on this car, that is in detail. And Vince did that front end
uh-huh.
in a hurry.
Uh-huh.
And Vince had the ability to... there were some of the details on the thing that showed up on some of the little sketches that we had pinned on the walls, but Vince put the thing together, really.
Yeah, uh-huh.
Did a hell of a job,
uh-huh.
and in a hurry, and management thought it was great, and so did the public. Anyhow, and now getting back to Gordon. All right, so we had this split-up situation, and Gordon hired Johnny Reinhart, a great personal friend of mine, passed on here recently. Got to be one. I didn't know him, but prior to that
right.
time, Jack Aldrich was there, and Jack came from GM. Jake, everybody in the business knew Jake. Jake was a chain smoker. Well, his name was Jack.
I mean,
John.
His nickname was Jake.
Jake.
Yeah, right.
Jake.
Okay.
And Jake was, as Jack Morgan used to tell me about Jake Aldrich when I worked in his office. You know, he'd tell me about all these characters: John Jarda and Jack Aldrich and Old Man Lutz, the first. Play modeler at GM.
Right, yes.
Yeah, oh gosh.
The legendary.
Legendary guy.
Uh-huh.
And Johnny Lutz, we tried to get him to come to the party, and finally Orville found out that he has just died most recently, young John Lutz. I mean, he'd be older than I am, you know. So Old Man Lutz's son that worked at Studebaker and one thing, John passed on. John drank a lot of booze and chased an awful lot of girls in his life. Of course, like a lot of the designers. Anyhow, like what's new, huh?
Yeah.
Anyhow. So let's see. Now we got to. There's Jack Aldrich. We got. Then he hired Audrey Moore Hodgson, I think her name is Hodges.
Just over here in Whitmore Lake.
And I think Orville tried to get a hold of her to come tonight.
He couldn't?
I don't know. I don't know whether he did or not. I reminded him that there's one we should try to get. And Lutz, I told him about him, and I know that, I don't know whether he contacted her or not, but I know he was going to do it, and he generally is pretty
He's
much
had
on.
Some eye problems.
She has?
Yeah.
Oh, goodness. I remember she had great big round eyes. She was a nice little girl.
How about Bob Cotto? Where did he come in?
Bob Cotto came in at that time also. That's another one that Gordon hired. I think it was primarily all Gordon that did the hiring on this. I was mixed up in a little bit of this. I remember coming up to the book Cadillac with A. Baker Barnhart to hire some people, and we interviewed some.
Barney Barnhart?
Yeah, Barney Barnhart. A. B. Barnhart. Barney was Louis' right-hand man,
right.
And Barney had matured through GM at one time, and from GM, he directly went to work for Louis in New York City, mm-hmm. and was with him all those years, and he died just about 2.5-3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
He was a real zammer, that guy. He was really something. he was really wild. Gosh. Well, he picked up all of the rough stuff that Louis ever had to dish out. I think he took most of it right on his back, you know what I mean? Yeah, that's tough. It really was. And I like Barney very much. He was not a designer, didn't profess to be one, but he'd come in and endeavor to contribute something from time to time, and sometimes he did. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you'd come up to the book I'd like to interview someone?
Yeah, that's right. And I came with Barney. And he and I sat in there, and I forget who it was we interviewed. It might have been that Gordon lined the guys up. I know Gordon knew John Reinhardt prior to this time.
Mm-hmm.
I know that, and we then, Barney and I, talked to some of them that we didn't know, or Louis didn't know, mm-hmm. or wanted Barney and I to review a little bit with these guys, and it might have been John. I think it was John Reinhardt, and I think it was Jack Aldrich that we talked to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And old Jake, he was fantastic. He would walk around, you know, he was a chain smoker all of his life. He weighed about 4 pounds. He was a very slight little guy. And he walked around like this constantly. Always, he'd hold a cigarette here, and he had one cupped hand which he caught the ashes in. All times, he'd talk to you like this, you know, always like this. Then he'd take a puff, and then he'd go back to here. And then he'd look and see if there were any ashes that dropped in his hand. If it was, he'd look for a wastebasket and he'd drop it.
Very fastidious.
Yeah, I think his wife taught him, I think.
And
dropping ashes all over the house. But Jack was funny. He's a great guy and he's a terrific watercolor artist.
Was
it? I've got some of his paintings that he gave. He'd sit down and knock out a little watercolor. Might measure, 6 by 12 or something like that. Very small. Sometimes there were miniatures like this.
Mm.
And there'd always be a small European car in the picture with the old buildings and the tobacco shop across the street and the girls walking. And it was so fast and so beautiful. You could do them in no time flat. Just unbelievable. They're really pieces of art. And the funny thing, in Westport at the Hunt Club, they have a fantastic antique show. My wife is interested in going to those things, and I go with her a lot of the time. And there are certain areas where some of the exhibitors sell paintings.
Mm-hmm.
And I was walking through there. As a matter of fact, my wife spotted it. And she said, "Look what's on the wall over there." And I looked, and she said, "That certainly looks like Jack Aldrich's watercolor work."
Really?
And I walked over there, and sure enough, it was signed on the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
I tried to buy it, and it had just been sold.
Oh, no.
Can you imagine that?
No.
Gosh. And the price was reasonable, you know. I'd have paid it a couple of $100 or something.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in any case, there are a lot of grand guys. Now, who else? Vince came at that time. Well, yeah, we talked about that already.
So it was Gordon who bridged the gap between the Lowy and the Exner factions, pretty much, at least for time.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And
they worked well together once Lowy left the scene.
Absolutely, they worked really well. Gordon and Lowy, there was always something amiss there. And I could see problems.
Gordon and Lowy too. Huh?
Well, Gordon and Lowy. Yeah, Gordon got along with Lowy, but Lowy, I don't know, always sort of looked awry at Gordon, or didn't ever really warm up to Gordon, and Gordon is the most friendly guy in the world, you know what I mean? It's just a tremendous guy.
Yeah.
Well, I was back on the board pushing pencils or clay modeling and keeping my nose out of all of this because I was just interested in doing, working and making a salary at the time,
sure.
You know what I mean?
Right.
So, let's see, where do we go from there? Well, the next thing that came up...
Well, excuse me, what, beyond, so the 47, however, was more than a facelift, was it not?
Oh, yeah, it was a brand new, it was an all new car.
Yeah.
Yeah, completely.
Who's responsible for the rest of the body?
Well, Virg Exner, I'd say.
Pretty much?
Yeah, pretty much. In other words, I was there, and I also did preliminary sketches, some of which would indicate some of the looks of the 47, and they were done way prior to production. I don't know if there's anything. There's Virg there.
Yeah, yeah.
Or let's get into those quick sketches area.
Oh, in the front, yeah.
Yeah, maybe. Good. Yeah, these things in here now. Well, you can see forerunners of a lot of stuff that came along later. Now, here's something there. I think that's the only one in here that indicates somewhat of the appearance
of the 47 student.
Of the 47, but this is the first rear engine job that I said was sort of preliminary
mm-hmm.
in style in certain areas, like this
right.
type of glass window and stuff like that. You know, all of these things rub off from
right.
what, you know,
sure.
what the
yeah.
hell.
Bits and pieces. So
yeah, sure. So, but you, yeah, X did basically the body. The only thing that you can say that is that Vince Gardner did the front end grill on that 47, and that was a hell of a nice grill on that
mm-hmm.
47.
Yes.
X did the commander grill, which was a nice grill also.
Right.
He did the commander.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so that more or less, I think, tells a story on those cars.
Well, that was a real winner. You were ahead of everybody.
Oh, yeah.
By at least a couple of years. A year,
well,
at least,
yeah.
yeah.
And the reason was is that I guess the GM and Ford were not in a position to tool up that fast or something, you know what
yeah.
I mean? It was a small company and it could move. Just because of its size, that's about the extent of it. So when they get to be big and things get to be pretty tough, there's just too many chiefs, you might say.
Right, yeah.
It can happen. And it does happen, but I think they're a little bit smarter now. They were back in those days. Okay, so that covered the 47. About that time, there was interest in trucks. We had the old M series Studebaker truck line, and the M series truck line, I think it was designed at Briggs,
mm-hmm.
and I think, and I have heard this, and I never knew for sure that Vince Gardner worked on that particular truck on the old M series. Now Gordon Buehrig might throw light on that. Not that that's too important at this
mm-hmm.
point, but in any
mm-hmm.
case, they wanted a new truck, and X didn't give a hoot about trucks. He just didn't care about trucks at all. I did. I liked trucks.
Did you?
And yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "Bob, go ahead and do a truck." And I think X at that time was in charge that week, and Gordon wasn't. But in any case, I was given the job, and
right.
Gordon concurred. It was all right with Gordon. Gordon wasn't much of a truck man either. It didn't excite him anyway.
Uh-huh.
But I was excited as hell to do a new pickup truck.
Mm-hmm.
So I designed the R series. The 2R5, it was a quarter ton pickup truck, and it was a good looking truck. I had the first truck to have inboard running boards.
Really?
It didn't have exposed running boards.
Uh-huh.
It had the pickup body was a smooth body. In other words, prior to that time, the pickup bodies had an inner shell, which in turn were turned out and rolled over, and the outside structure, and they were a raw looking body with hat sections spot welded to the. And I wanted to do it the other way around and
mm-hmm.
clean up the side of the, so the body, the pickup body was a smooth sided body on the outside, the first one that was ever made, and that's
mm-hmm.
the way they build them today.
Mm-hmm.
I did the cab, the doors, the hood, worked it out in full size. I even did the lettering on the back of the pickup body that said Studebaker, Studebaker, and I did that at Murray Body Company up here in Detroit.
That was the first, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of course, everybody put the name on them back in after that.
Sure, they sure did.
And I was pretty proud of that Studebaker script.
Oh, that was a beauty.
Yeah. Another thing I'm proud of, strangely enough, is the numerals that showed up on the 53 instrument panels. And it's the numerals on the speedometer and
mm-hmm.
Odometer. ammeter, gas gauge, and one thing and another. The style of the lettering of the numerals. And I laid all that out and had it reduced down and had the instrument faces done just the way I wanted them. And the numerals.
Sans serif or?
No, I designed the numerals. You cannot find that in a book. Can't find that in a book anywhere. And they're still a hell of a beautiful numeral.
You got sketches of them?
No, not at all. I've got some panels, you know. They're really handsome things.
You should try to reproduce that.
Oh, yeah, it's easy to do. You can reproduce them. But
what the characteristics did the numerals have in the
letter? They were relatively tall and relatively thin. You can I don't know if you've got a Studebaker here, but take a look at them. So you've got a 53, and they're interesting. I always was interested in graphics, too. It's strange. And when I got into business myself, Claire Hodgman and I went in business. We did quite a lot of graphic work.
You've said that Lowy was a great graphic designer.
He was good.
Yeah.
He was very good. He could swing a script right in front of your eyes.
Really?
But he couldn't draw automobiles. Not at all.
No.
He was just ridiculous as far as cars were concerned. Uh-huh. And he sort of knew it, you know.
But he was a good editor, though, wasn't he?
Oh, yeah. He was. Yeah. And I had really, he'd always ask my opinion. If we'd have a meeting sometimes, I can remember. Now, Bob, when they come in, he would say, and if they ask you, you listen to everything, every question that they might address me with. And because, and sometimes he said, it's difficult for me with my French to tell them the way I want to tell them. He actually was saying to me that, you know, this is tough because I don't know what the answer is.
You're right.